Prem Yellow by Aldous Huxley, read from LibriVox.org by Martin Clifton. Chapter 27. Mr. Scobin had been accommodated in a little canvas hut, dressed in a black skirt and a red bodice with a yellow and red bandana handkerchief tied round his black wig. He looked sharp-nosed, brown and wrinkled, like the Bohemian hag of Fifth Derby Day. Placards pinned to the curtain of the doorway announced the presence within the tent of Sesostris, the sorceress of Ecbatana. Seated at the table, Mr. Scobin received his clients in mysterious silence, indicating with the movement of a finger that they were to sit down opposite him and to extend their hands for his inspection. He then examined the palm that was presented him, using a magnifying glass and a pair of horn spectacles. He had a terrifying way of shaking his head, frowning and clicking with his tongue as he looked at the lines. Sometimes he would whisper as though to himself, "Terrible, terrible," or "God preserve us," sketching out the sign of the cross as he uttered the words. The clients who came in laughing grew suddenly grave. They began to take the witch seriously. She was a formidable-looking woman. Could it be, was it possible that there was something in this sort of thing after all? After all, they thought, as the hag shook her head over their hands, after all, and they waited with an uncomfortably beating heart for the oracle to speak. Mr. Scobin would suddenly look up and ask in a hoarse whisper some horrifying questions such as, "Have you ever been hit on the head with a hammer by a young man with red hair?" When the answer was in the negative, which it could hardly fail to be, Mr. Scobin would nod several times, saying, "I was afraid so. Everything is still to come, still to come, though it can't be very far off now." Sometimes, after a long examination, he would just whisper, "Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise," and refuse to divulge any details of the future too appalling to be envisaged without despair. Sesostris had a success of horror. People stood in a queue outside the witch's booth, waiting for the privilege of hearing sentence pronounced upon them. Dennis, in the course of his round, looked with curiosity at this crowd of suppliants before the shrine of the oracle. He had a great desire to see how Mr. Scobin played his part. The canvas booth was a rickety, ill-made structure. Between its walls and its sagging roof were long, gaping chinks and crannies. Dennis went to the tea tent and borrowed a wooden bench and a small Union Jack. With these, he hurried back to the booth of Sesostris. Setting down the bench at the back of the booth, he climbed up and, with a great air of busy efficiency, began to tie the Union Jack to the top of one of the tent poles. which seemed to ignore her remark. Afterwards, it's not at all clear the fates don't say whether you will settle down to married life and have 4 children, or whether you will try to go on the cinema and have none. They are only specific about this one rather crucial incident. What is it? What is it? Oh, do tell me. The white muslin figure leant eagerly forward. Mr. Scogan sighed. Very well, he said. If you must know, you must know. But if anything untoward happens, you must blame your own curiosity. Listen, listen. He lifted up a sharp, claw-nailed forefinger. This is what the fates have written. Next Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock, you will be sitting on the second stile on the footpath that leads from the church to the lower road. At that moment, a man will appear walking along the footpath. Mr. Scogan looked at her hand again as though to refresh his memory of the details of the scene. A man, he repeated, a small man with a sharp nose, not exactly good looking nor precisely young, but fascinating. He lingered hissingly over the wall. He will ask you, can you tell me the way to paradise? And you will answer, yes, I will show you, and walk with him down towards the little hazel copse. I cannot read what will happen after that. Is it really true? Asked White Muslin. The witch gave a shrug of the shoulders. I merely tell you what I read in your hand. Good afternoon, that will be sixpence. Yes, I have changed, thank you. Good afternoon. Dennis stepped down from the bench, tied in securely and crookedly to the tent pole. The Union Jack hung limp on the wind of his hair. If only I could do things like that, he thought, as he carried the bench back to the tea tent. Anne was sitting behind a long table, filling thick white cups from an urn. A neat pile of printed sheets lay before her on the table. Dennis took one of them and looked at it affectionately. It was his poem. They had printed 500 copies, and very nice the quarto and broadsheets looked. Have you sold many? He asked in a casual tone. Anne put her head on one side deprecatingly. Only 3 so far, I'm afraid, but I'm giving a free copy to everyone who spends more than a shilling on his tea. So in any case, it's having a circulation. Dennis made no reply, but walked slowly away. He looked at the broadsheet in his hand and read the lines to himself relishingly as he walked along. This day of roundabouts and swings, struck weights, shied coconuts, tossed rings, switchbacks, aunt Sally's, and all such small hijinks. But paper noses sniffed the artificial roses of round Venetian cheeks through half each carnival year, and masks might laugh at things quite smelled. He lit a cigarette. The smell of cows was preferable. He passed through the gate into the park wall, into the garden. The swimming pool was a center of noise and activity. Second heat in the Young Ladies' Championship. It was the polite voice of Henry Wimbush. The crowd of sleek, seal-like figures in black bathing dresses surrounded him. His grey bowler hat, smooth, round, and motionless in the midst of a moving sea, was an island of aristocratic calm. Holding his tortoiseshell rimmed pince nez an inch or two in front of his eyes, he read out names from the list. Miss Dolly Miles, Miss Rebecca Ballister, Miss Doris Gadell. Five young persons ranged themselves on the brink. From their seats of honour at the other end of the pool, old Lord Merlin and Mr. Calamay looked on with eager interest. Henry Wimbush raised his hand, with an expectant silence. When I say go, 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 he said. There was an almost simultaneous splash. Dennis pushed his way through the spectators. Somebody plucked him by the sleeve. He looked down at old Mrs. Budge. Delighted to see you again, Mr. Stone, she said in her rich, husky voice. She panted a little as she spoke, like a short-winded lapdog. It was Mrs. Budge who, having read in the Daily Mirror that the government needed peach stones, what they needed them for she never knew, had made the collection of peach stones her peculiar bit of wall work. She had 36 peach trees in her walled garden, as well as 4 hothouses in which trees could be forced, so that she was able to eat peaches practically the whole year round. In 1916, she ate 4,200 peaches and sent the stones to the government. In 1917, the military authorities called up 3 of her daughters, and what with this and the fact that it was a bad year for wall fruit, she only managed to eat 2,900 peaches during that crucial period of the national destinies. In 1918, she did rather better, for between January the 1st and the date of the armistice, she ate 3,300 peaches. Since the armistice, she had relaxed her efforts. Now she did not eat more than 2 or 3 peaches a day. Her constitution, she complained, had suffered, but it had suffered for a good cause. Dennis answered her greeting by a vague and polite noise. So nice to see the young people enjoying themselves, Mrs. Budge went on. And the old people too, for that matter. Look at old Lord Merlin and dear Mr. Calamay. Isn't it delightful to see the way they enjoy themselves? Dennis looked. He wasn't sure whether it was so very delightful after all. Why didn't they go and watch the sack races? The two old gentlemen were engaged at the moment in congratulating the winner of the race. It seemed an act of 16, slender but newborn, he said to himself, and laid up the phrase in his memory as a happy one. Old Mr. Callaway had put on his spectacles to congratulate the victor, and Lord Merlin, leaning forward over his walking stick, showed his long, ivory teeth hungrily smiling. Capital performance, capital, Mr. Callaway was saying in his deep voice. The victor wriggled with embarrassment. She stood with her hands behind her back, rubbing one foot nervously on the other, her wet bathing dress shawl, a torso of black polished marble. Very good indeed, said Lord Merlin, his voice to come from just behind his teeth, a toothy voice. It was as though a dog should suddenly begin to speak. He smiled again. Mr. Callaway readjusted his spectacles. When I say go, go, go. Splash! The third heat had started. Do you know, I never could learn to swim, said Mr. Punch. Really? But I used to be able to float. Dennis imagined her floating up and down on a great green swell, a blown black bladder. No, that wasn't good. That wasn't good at all. The new winner was being congratulated. She was atrociously stubby and fat. The last one long and harmoniously continuously curved from knee to breast had been an E by Cranach, but this one was a bad Rubens. Go, go, go. Henry Wimbush's polite level voice once more pronounced the formula. Another batch of young ladies dived in. Grown a little weary of sustaining a conversation with Mrs. Budge, Dennis conveniently remembered that his duties as a steward called him elsewhere. He pushed out through the lines of spectators and made his way along the path left clear behind them. He was thinking again that his soul was a pale, tenuous membrane, when he was startled by hearing a thin, sibilant voice speaking, apparently from just above his head, pronounce the single word disgusting. He looked up sharply. The path along which he was walking passed under the lee of a wall of clipped yew. Behind the hedge, the ground sloped steeply up towards the foot of the terrace and the house. For once,